Hi, my name is Jason Baldwin. I did 18 years for a crime I didn't commit. I came out of prison as a better person, as a person who has their eyes open to what can happen to innocent people, that innocent people can go to prison, and I want to help other innocent people not go to prison and help other innocent people that are in prison get out.
Hi, you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast dedicated to spreading awareness of wrongful convictions. I'm Brooke, and today I am so excited that we will be talking with Jason Baldwin. He was a part of the group that's referred to as the West Memphis Three. Jason and I met at the Innocence Conference, and he said he would love to do this show. But first, this episode is being brought to you by two sponsors, Pearl Flowers and Hunt a Killer. Thank you so much for supporting our show through supporting our sponsors. Having two sponsors this week means my cats and I will get to eat and have electricity. So we really appreciate that. Okay, let's be real here. Have you ever forgotten your anniversary or a birthday? Do you want to get a gift for someone, but you know they're just so hard to shop for? Well, you can express your gratitude, sympathy, or let's face it, your guilt, because right now, Pro Flowers has a special offer for just our listeners. You get $10 off your purchase of $29 or more. And to snag this great deal, just go to proflowers.com and enter code AI, like the initials for Actual Innocence. I love letting people know that I appreciate their efforts. And after having the most incredible experience of my life, ever, I wanted to thank Meredith, the organizer of the Innocence Conference. So I decided to send her some Pro Flowers. And let me tell you, she was thrilled. She said they were great. Plus, I was able to send them to her in New York, from where I live in Indiana, with very little time and effort. I wasn't worried at all about the quality, because Pro Flower bouquets are guaranteed fresh for 7 days, or you get your money back. Plus, their website is super easy to navigate and use. So, do yourself a favor and help our show out by supporting Pro Flowers. I know you have to have a birthday or an anniversary coming up. So right now, get $10 off your purchase of $29 or more at Pro Flowers. But hurry, this deal definitely won't last long. Remember, just go to proflowers.com and enter code AI at checkout to get the special deal. Don't often get to meet the people that I interview before we do the actual recording. So I am thrilled to say I have met and shaken hands with Jason. If you go back a couple of episodes and listen to season 2, episode 6, you'll hear him introduce himself at the conference. No more interruptions. This is Jason's story. What was your life like before this whole experience happened? I mean, you were a teenager, right?
I just turned 16 right before I was arrested. I turned 16 on April the 11th. I was arrested on June the 3rd of 1993. And my life had experienced lots of up and downs. I love my mom. I love my brothers, but my mom divorced my dad when I was 4. She remarried when I was 5. And the guy she married, he was the father of my youngest brother, Terry, but he had alcohol problems and things like that. So it was kind of a roller coaster with him where he'd be sober and everything would be great, but then he'd, be a drunk again and be totally abusive and violent towards my family and, towards my mom and my brothers and stuff. And so we moved from Memphis, Tennessee to get away from him to West Memphis, Arkansas, and moved into some property that my grandmother had on the lake. And, she owned the trailer she lived in. She owned another trailer that she rented out, and she just totally gave us the trailer on the lake because, we were young boys and we liked the water. We liked the lake. We liked fishing and swimming. So, but then, my mom really loved my stepdad and he promised to get better and to work on his alcoholism better and stuff. And so, she allowed him to move back in and everything, but he had already, he couldn't get away from alcohol. You know, it was a big thing, you know, and so the abuse followed, and he punched my mom and punched us, punched the babysitter sometimes, you know. I mean, he just got really violent and everything. And so my mom had finally, again, like, gotten the strength to, like, kick him out of the house, basically. And so my mom went from being a housewife to getting her GED and getting a job in Memphis. And so we were like, we had like this family plan where she's like, okay, we work hard, we save up enough money, and then we can move back to Memphis, Tennessee and get a house and rent our trailer out. Cause like I said, my grandmother gave us the trailer and, well, gave us a car too. So my mom had a car, she had a trailer that we didn't have to pay anything on. So it kind of enabled us to make savings and stuff. So when they arrested me, you know, it's kind of pulled the chair out from under my mom and made things super difficult for her because the community turned against her. Her employer told her, you know, I understand you're going to be at your, going to go to your son's, you know, hearings and trial and stuff, but you're just not going to have a job. So it's one of those stories that, you know, that's really common when you look at wrongful conviction and look at people who have been put away in prison for something they didn't do, you know, because they come from broken homes and things like that, and they're not able to mount a defense, you know, can't defend themselves, can't hire attorneys and things like that. And so even though I had a loving family as far as my mom and brothers, and, you know, and that aspect, didn't have much in the way of finances to support us, to, you know, and then the community turned on us. So it was hard.
What can you tell me about the crime that you were accused of?
Well, it was a horrible crime. 3 8-year-old boys were murdered. We still don't know exactly why or who did it, what the motivations were or any of those things. But because the police couldn't find who committed the crimes, they made up this narrative about it having been done as part of a satanic ritual, and that prejudiced the community and the jury enough to convict me, my best friend Damien, and this other kid, Jesse, Miss Kelly, of it, because they said, well, these kids, you know, wear rock and roll t-shirts, they have long hair, you know, so they must be part of a cult, and if they're part of a cult, they must have committed this crime. Right. So they just made these leaps in logic. Right.
Yeah. So because everyone who wears rock and roll t-shirts is part of a cult, right?
That's what they said, you know, and it's real. It was mind boggling because you're like, yes, I wore rock and roll t-shirts, you know, yes, I had long hair, but I am not in a cult. I'm, you know, not a Satanist, and I definitely did not commit this crime, but people could not separate those things from in their minds, and, you know, they couldn't separate the two, you know, so it was like an insurmountable hurdle to cross because there basically was no presumption of innocence.
How long between the crime before you were arrested?
The crime happened on May the 5th of 1993. I was arrested on my last day of school on June the 3rd, which was the Thursday of 1993. So almost a month, right?
Did you even know what you were being arrested for?
Well, they told us, you know, when they came in and said, hey, you're arrested for murder. And well, first they came and got Damien, and I was over at Damien's house, you know, staying the night, watching movies. Like, his mom had rented a VCR and rented these horrible B movies. Leprechaun was one, and we never did finish that. And somebody sent me a copy of that since I've been free, and I still haven't watched it. But, you know, but before that, I remember not too long after the murders that happened, you know, I heard about it at school on Thursday at school because we had TVs in the classroom, you know, and sometimes a teacher would have movies or something like that about the class, some type of topic germane to the class. But they came and turned all the TVs on and was like, hey, look at the TVs. And there were these boys that had apparently gone missing the day before, and they had found their bodies that day in a creek or a bayou or something, and it just freaked everybody out, you know. And at this time, they weren't saying it was a satanic cult. They were just saying, you know, a horrible triple murder. And at the time, my youngest brother, Terry, was 9 years old, and he got mistaken for being 6 years old a lot because he was so small. And people, you know, I was 16. People thought I was 13 or 14 because I was so small for my age at the time. My brothers were small. We were small. And I just remember thinking, you know, whoa, that could have been little Terry, you know. And so when I went home that day from school, my mom, who normally went to work like an hour before school let out, about 2:30 in Memphis, because she was a nighttime dispatcher at this trucking agency, she like didn't go to work. She stayed home. She's like, hey, I don't know if you heard this or not, but, you know, they found these three boys, you know, murdered in West Memphis. I want you all to stay home. Don't go anywhere until they figure out who did this. And, you know, it kind of sucked. As a kid, you got to stay at home. It's kind of like almost being grounded for something you didn't do. But at the same time, you know, got to watch out for my little brothers. And it wasn't that bad because we had the lake in the backyard. We had Super Nintendo and stereo and stuff. So we entertained ourselves. We had good times at the house, but still you can't go anywhere or do anything, but we could have company come over. But at the same time, you're still, even though you're a kid, you're still worried about what happened in West Memphis. And I say what happened in West Memphis because my brothers and I, we all went to Marion schools. We lived in Marion, which is a totally different city. But even though they're like side by side and you have to go through West Memphis to get to Memphis, Tennessee. But for us kids, it's like a million miles away, you know. And so, but we were still scared and stuff. Friday or Saturday, they came to my house, two detectives, and started questioning, you know, called me and called Damien and his girlfriend at the time, Dominique, out of the house and, you know, started asking these questions about the murders and stuff. And before this, Damien had already told me that they had come to his house and made him take off his shirt and they took photographs of him and stuff like that and asked him where he was and stuff. And he's like, you know, he honest with them, told him where he was at, what he was doing. You know, he wasn't trying to hide anything, you know, because he didn't do anything wrong. He just, and like I figured, you know, just thought that the police were just going door to door, asking anybody and everybody what they knew, you know, and things like that. But what I realized when they came to my house and were questioning, they started trying to, what I know now, it's called the Reed method, but at the time I didn't know it, but I just thought it was really weird the way they were questioning, because they would lead off, do you think it was possible that one of the kids drowned, you know, and Damien's like, I don't know how they died, you know, I've heard all these rumors, and they're just like, you know, take a leap of faith, just play along with us, you know, do you think it's possible? And he was just like, well, yeah, I guess anything's possible. And later on, when we would go to court and trial, that same detective would say that Damien supplied him that information, that Damien said one of them was drowned, when that wasn't the case. He actually made Damien go down this questioning road and answer a question, do you think it's possible if they were drowned? He's like, I don't know, I guess so. But when the detective testified about it, he said that Damien told him that one of them drowned. So,
did he have any representation with him when they were doing that?
No, they didn't. He didn't, and neither did I. And luckily, you know, my mom come and showed up. Like, she came home from work early and was like, "Hey, y'all need to leave and not mess with my kid and stuff like that." When I was 11, I got in trouble for playing hide and go seek, but they convicted me for breaking and entering and criminal trespassing and all these things. But it was the whole neighborhood. We were like, the whole neighborhood was playing hide and go seek in these old tin sheds. I mean, they'd been there for years. They had dirt floors with giant weeds growing up, and like the tree outside had like grown, I don't know how long it takes a tree to grow, like 50, 60, 80, I don't know, 100 years, I don't know. But this tree had grown, and like its width had pushed in the wall, right? It had been growing there for so long and like busted through the wall and lifted the roof off the place, right? And so there are these old, like rusted up, broken up car frames and stuff in there. And I remember, this is like right after we moved to West Memphis, or moved to Marion from Memphis, Tennessee, in between the fifth and sixth grades. And, you know, we're just playing with all the kids there and stuff. And I remember pretending like the cars were like X-Wing fighters from Star Wars. And we were just playing hide and seek in there, you know, and just, I mean, none of us broke anything in there. None of us destroyed anything. We didn't break anything to enter. You know, we just climbed the tree from the outside, and then climbed the tree back down on the inside, because it was like inside and outside of this place, right? And I remember the police came and took us all, you know, it was me, my brother Matt, and like all the kids from the trailer park. I mean, maybe about 13 to 20 kids, a bunch of kids, and they arrested all of us. And next thing I know, I have to go to see a public defender, Mr. Montgomery. And he was like, you know, this is nothing, you know, I wouldn't worry about it. Nothing's going to happen. You know, you're not going to be in any trouble. Just don't, make sure you don't ever go there again. And you go, yeah, definitely never. Cause it was scary to get arrested, scary to get taken to the police station and all this stuff. Next thing I know, I'm going to court. Me and my brother and all the kids are, and the prosecuting attorney, who is the same prosecutor in the case that sent me to prison for life without, John Fogelman, he tells the judge, I think 2 years in the state reform school would do all these boys some good. My public defender, Mr. Montgomery, stood up and said, I agree, Your Honor, which totally blew my mind, because he just got through telling us all, you know, don't worry about anything. Nothing's going to happen. You know, they're going to throw it out. Y'all didn't do anything wrong. This is a mistake. And my mom jumped up in the courtroom and said, my sons aren't going to prison, because basically that's what reform school is prison for kids. And so next thing I know, they're all, the judge calls the lawyers to the bench, and my mom goes to the bench, and somehow or another, we made some type of plea deal to where, instead of getting 2 years in their form school, we got 5 years probation and $500 fine each, right? And what I found out later is we basically pled guilty to breaking property and stuff in there and breaking into the place and everything. And at the time, I didn't understand any of that. All I knew is, yeah, I'd been in there. Yeah, I'd played hide and go seek. There weren't any signs saying no trespassing or anything like that. I mean, the place looked like it had been abandoned for years and years and years. You know, if anything had destroyed anything in there, it was time and weather. Not us kids, but they would use that to give us a record. And I remember.
And were you still on probation then? Because you said you were, what, 11? And then you were 16 when you were.
Yes, I was still on probation. And so.
Oh, no.
I was used to having to talk to police and having to talk to a probation officer. I was assigned a probation officer, Mr. Steve Jones. And me and my brother Matt, my mom would have to go to his office. He had an office right next to the Marion courthouse in Marion. We'd have to go there, I mean, almost every month. And, you know, just, and honestly, he wasn't a bad guy. He didn't treat me bad. He didn't treat my brother Matt bad. He would just be like, all right, you know, what are y'all doing in school? How's it going? You know, what's your home life like? And he'd buy us a soda pop, you know, he'd give me a dollar. He'd be like, run there and get a couple of sodas for you and your brother. And so I'd run to the courthouse, right, and get us a couple of soda pops and come back. You know, so it that part wasn't traumatic, really, and it didn't really feel like I was in trouble, because, like I said, I didn't do anything wrong, you know. I didn't, besides playing hide and go seek, but at the same time, we still had a $500 fine each. And so for my mom, that was $1,000. And there were other kids' parents in the neighborhood who, like, just down the road from me, this one lady, she had four kids who got in trouble. So that was $2,000 for her. And now this trailer park, nobody there is really rich. We were lucky that my grandmother gave us the trailer we lived in, you know, and that she owned two trailers. So we were kind of, I guess, more lucky than most of the people there. I remember our Christmas budget for the whole family was $100. And so this kind of like just wiped us out. But my mom was able, she didn't have to pay it all at once, which she never would have been able to do. So they made it a thing where she would just had to pay like $20 a month or something like that. You know, so whenever we would go see to the probation officer in Mr. Jones' office, she would pay some of the money into it, you know. So as long as she showed that she was working on paying it and everything, and as long as me and Matt didn't get in trouble or whatever, we'd be okay. And sometimes I'd be at school and Mr. Jones would go to the principal's office and I'd be in class, and all of a sudden on the intercom, they'd be like, send Baldwin to the principal's office, or send Jason to the principal's office, you know? And so I'd have to go to the principal's office, leave class. And the way this kind of worked is, and all those kids, we lived in the trailer park, but the people who went to the school didn't. The majority of the people did not live in the trailer park. They lived in houses and stuff like that. They were more financially stable. They had more money and things like that. And so what ended up happening is, over years, people got used to me and all these other kids being called to the principal's office. And so teachers and stuff would ask, why are these kids always being called to the principal's office? And someone would say, well, they've got probation officer, right? Oh, well, they must be troublemakers. They must be problem kids. And so that fed into the prejudice that, you know, that we, you know, suffered at because of that arrest and everything.
I need to take a second to tell you about this new subscription box service called Hunt a Killer. Maybe you remember me telling you about it, or you've heard about it somewhere else, but let me tell you, people are obsessed. Hunt a Killer sends a package to your home each month full of creepy correspondence from their killer curator. He's a little like Hannibal Lecter, and he's got a mystery for you to solve. Each month, you'll receive new clues, letters, articles, objects, tools, all adding to an ongoing murder mystery. It's up to you, along with all of the thousands of members working together in our online communities. It's the perfect thing for an armchair detective looking to put their sleuthing skills to the test. You can join by logging on to huntakiller.com and applying for membership. Hunt a Killer is growing so fast that they have to limit the number of new members to 500 a week. Once you apply and you're approved, you'll receive a private link to subscribe. Then a package arrives on your door each month. Waiting is the hardest part. They've just been featured in BuzzFeed, Fast Company, and Bustle. Oh, and a blog on my website. I just got box 2 and I can't wait to get started. Hunt a Killer is forming a cult-like community of web sleuths and amateur detectives. If you love poring over creepy codes, ciphers, and clues, Hunt a Killer is simply perfect. And if it's not for you, I have a feeling you know at least one person that would love to receive it as a gift. I cannot recommend this membership enough. So, to help support our show, Hunt a Killer has offered a 10% discount for our listeners, which is tracked through this message. So, you can join by logging on to huntakiller.com and use the code CLUE to get 10% off. That's CLUE.
Years later, Damien moved to Marion, and he started going out with this girl, Deanna, who lived in Marion in the house, right? And her father got so upset. It's like, oh, you're not going to date a kid from Lakeshore Trailer Park. They're all trouble. They all have jail records. They're all criminals and stuff like that. And even though he wasn't one of the kids who were playing hide and go seek, he suffered prejudice for it, right? And so her parents forbade them from seeing one another, right? They're like, you can't see each other. You know, you're not going to be able to go to his house and he's not going to be able to come here.
It sounds like the trailer park was stigmatized. Just, you know, living there made you a bad person. That's horrible.
Exactly. That's how people viewed us and everything. And that's how people treated us who didn't know us. And it's not like they even tried to get to know us and find out what the story was. It was automatic. You don't mess with these people because they're from the trailer park and they all have criminal records. They're bad people, you know? And so for Damien and Deanna, you know, they would, okay, we can see each other at school, man. And so you'd see them, you know, in between class, they'd be holding hands and stuff going. He'd be carrying her books to class and stuff like that, you know, for her and stuff. But then her dad found out about that and would call the principal and call the school and was like, hey, I know, y'all are allowing this to happen. Y'all need to put a stop to it. I don't want my daughter being anywhere around that guy. You know, he's a troublemaker. He's from the trailer park and stuff. And so the school officials got involved and like made it to where they couldn't even see each other at school. And so they got desperate and came up with a plan like, well, if we can't see each other, won't know and allow us to see each other, we're going to run away. Right. They were pushed to run away. And so Damien and Deanna, that's what they did. Like they, one day they just decided to run away. Like they packed their stuff up and left school. And instead of each of them going home, they went together and hid in like an abandoned trailer for a little while because it was a big storm and it was raining and stuff. But the police somehow found them and arrested Damien and like sent him to training school. And he like suffered a nervous breakdown during all that and was confined to a mental hospital. He suffered from depression and manic depression, but when you're in jail, they don't always give you the right medication. And then to go to training school, that's like prison for kids. So you're picked on and then not getting your medication. And so he had a nervous breakdown while there. And so when these murders happened, he did have a record for, you know, running away with his girlfriend. And so he suffered the prejudice of that. He suffered the prejudice of having mental health issues, which a lot of people in America have. And a lot of people, you know, they just are normal people that just need medical attention, but people shun them and ostracize them and pick on them. And the system does that. And so,
right. I don't know if you know this or not, but actually my day job is a therapist. Like I work with kids who have mental health issues and behavior disorders. And I have seen so many kids blossom. I mean, they're good kids. Just because, you know, sometimes they have some issues doesn't make them a bad kid. But the stigma that comes with a diagnosis is horrendous.
Right. Exactly. And so, yeah. And this shouldn't be like that. And so when the murders happened and they started, you know, coming around questioning, you know, people who had a record, they started questioning Damien and they started questioning me. And honestly, I think this is what I've learned since I've been, you know, locked up and everything, which I didn't know at the time. The night the boys went missing, there was this Bojangles restaurant and this guy came into the Bojangles restaurant and come climbing up out of the ditch where the boys' bodies would be found the next day, covered in mud and blood. And the manager for the Bojangles restaurant called the police like, hey, we got this guy who's coming into the store or the restaurant, and he's covered in mud and blood, and he went into the women's restroom and locked himself in. Would you send an officer to, like, you know, deal with this person? And so they called Officer Regina Meeks, who was on patrol. And at the time she was actually looking for the boys who were missing. And so when she came through there, she came through the drive-through window and they're like, hey, he just left. He's somewhere out here. And so she didn't go inside the store. She's like, okay, well, I'm looking for some kids. And now I'm looking for this guy who's covered in mud and blood. So I understand later on during the trial, people would give her trouble for not going inside the Bojangles, but at that time she was searching for missing kids and the guy wasn't even in there anymore, right? He'd already left. So I figured she was like, okay, if I just drive around here, I'll probably see him somewhere and I can get him that away, you know. And but she never saw him. She never saw the kids. Well, the next day when the police found the boys' bodies in that ditch, you know, they were like, oh my God, you know, last night, this guy came crawling out of the ditch and went into the Bojangles restaurant. Let's go to the Bojangles restaurant right now and see if there's any evidence left, right? And so they went to the Bojangles restaurant and found and took some blood scrapings, right? But they left a pair of sunglasses for some reason that the guy had left, which, you know, that glasses and sunglasses are the perfect thing for holding fingerprints. So they messed up when they didn't take that. And then there was like a toilet paper roll with blood all over it. They didn't take that. They should have taken. But even though they took scrapings of blood samples that he left. So they could have used that to, you know, to send in to get DNA testing or blood testing or whatever it was they had, you know, available at the time, but they didn't. And so I think when they lost that evidence, they had all this pressure from the community to find who committed the crime. And they were probably like, we're probably never going to find this guy. We need to pin it on somebody, you know? And so they came up with this whole idea of blaming it on Satanism. And so they started, like I said, they came and questioned Damien and took a picture of him with his shirt off, right? And now, if he had actually committed the crime, he would have had some type of wound or something on him. You know, the kids would have fought back or something maybe. And like, but it just showed him like just, you know, normal with no shirt. You know, he didn't have any type of wounds or something, anything like that, you know, to show that he was involved in a murder or something. But they went around showing this picture of Damien and asking people, have you heard of any cult activities, any, you know, satanic stuff like that, you know? And so they were planting it in people's heads that there was something satanic going on, right? And so that's what they did to the whole town. And at the time, you know, I just thought they were just asking everybody with a record and going door to door asking people. But what they were doing is they were basically creating a smear campaign, right? They were just planting all these thoughts into people's heads of Satanism and stuff like that. So when they did arrest us, it wouldn't be a surprise to the community. So the boys came up missing on May the 5th. Their bodies were found on May the 6th. And of course the news was covering it and everything. The rumor mill was rampant about, you know, at first they thought it was it could have been a transient, somebody from the truckers, a trucker or something like that. But then when the police started showing Damien's photograph around asking if they had seen this guy or heard of any cult activity, then people started talking about satanic stuff and satanic rumors and things like that. Well, on May the 15th, it's in the record that Jesse Miskelly and another boy out of his trailer park in Highland Trailer Park went to the police and said they saw somebody suspicious in their neighborhood and the police should check on this guy, right? And thinking, you know, that they would get some reward money. Like Jesse was like, okay, now where's my reward money? And the police told him, well, you know, you can't get any reward money just for thinking somebody's suspicious. You have to come back with a better story than that, Jesse. And that was on May the 15th, right? Well, on June the 3rd, right, after hearing all these satanic rumor stuff, right, Jesse comes back to the or the police come to him, actually, this time. It's like, hey, we hear you're friends with Damien, or you know Damien. He's like, oh, yeah, I went to school with him, you know, and they ask him, you know, if he's a Satanist. And so Jesse's thinking about earning the reward money, so he starts telling him, yeah, I think he's a Satanist and stuff. And so they lead him down this story where Jesse's at first just, you know, telling him, you know, telling the police where he was at that day and stuff like that. But next thing you know, they use the Reed method on him and get Jesse to say he was at the crime and he witnessed Damien and me commit the crime and all this stuff. But you could tell from the interviews and stuff, he really didn't know what he was talking about. But they had laid the photographs of the boys' bodies in front of him. And like, so every wound on the boys, they were like, all right, tell us how this wound happened. Tell us how this wound happened. So he just started making up stories about how each wound could have happened. And later on, you know, through forensic science, we would learn that all of those wounds couldn't have happened the way he said, because a lot of it was animal predation, because like turtles and stuff had started eating their bodies because they were in the water all night long and stuff like that. But Jesse didn't know that. He also, you know, Jesse didn't go to school at this time. And like at one point he says, you know, it's during the day, during school hours, he said that, you know, Damien and me and him committed this crime and the boys that skipped school and stuff. And, you know, the police knew this was wrong, or they either didn't know it was wrong or found out it was wrong later. So they had him like come back and change his story. They're like, Jesse, you weren't wearing a watch. So it could have been later in the evening. And he's just like totally agreeing with him, like, yeah, it was later in the evening. So they just kept, you know, giving him details and details and showing him pictures and stuff until they had a believable enough story to arrest us all. And if you look on false confessions and stuff, you know, in so many different cases, you know, with the Reed technique, they do this to people all the time, especially, you know, kids, and especially kids who have developmental issues, which Jesse did have. He, like, when I first met him, I was in the sixth grade, but he had already did like 2 years in the sixth grade. And then later on, when I made it to the ninth grade, he like made it to the ninth grade, but they just passed him, right? And then when I went to the 10th grade, he stayed in the ninth grade until he just quit school, you know? So he wasn't, you know, the smartest, or he wasn't as developmentally well as most kids are, you know? And then, you know, they just totally preyed on him, and at the, you know, and he really wasn't a person who had the highest morality anyway, you know, because later on, well, a few years ago, while I was still in prison, my private investigator who works for my attorney is like, hey, I solved a mystery. And at first I thought, he's like, oh, you solved, like, who did this? He's like, no, not that mystery. But he goes, do you remember getting kicked out of the skating rink one night, you and Damien? And I was like, yeah, we were playing pool. And the security guard, like, came and, like, told me and Damien we have to leave, right? And I was like, why? And he was just like, oh, you know why. Don't play stupid. And I was like, oh, my God, what, you know, what's going on? You know, he's like, well, you got to call your mom to come get you, all right? And he would never, the security guard wouldn't tell us why we were getting kicked out. Well, my private investigator found out that Jesse had stolen a pool ball from the pool, one of the pool tables, and blamed it on me and Damien and got us kicked out.
Oh, no.
Right? So he had this habit of doing things that's not right anyway, you know, and then for the police to, you know, just force him into a false confession, you know, wasn't that difficult for them to do, because they were just used to doing that, you know?
Right. It sounds a lot like, have you seen Making a Murderer?
Yes. Yes.
Like the Brendan Dassey of...
Brendan Dassey. Yes. See, it happens to kids all the time. Like, I remember, at one point, Jesse, like, took a polygraph exam, like, and when he was still professing his innocence, and he passed it, but they told him that he failed it, you know? They said, Jesse, your brain has told us that you're lying, so you might as well tell the truth, you know? So he was so hopeless and felt like, you know, he, you know, nothing he can say could win anyway, that he might as well go along with whatever story they want.
So what was the trial like? I mean, there were three of you. Were you tried together? Were you tried separately? How did that work?
They tried Jesse in February, and then they tried me and Damien in March.
Together? Like, you were in the same courtroom?
Yeah, together. But they told us, yeah, we were in the same courtroom, but they told us our trials were separate, like, to only view evidence against Damien and don't count it against me, and vice versa. And the reason they separated Jesse's trial from ours is because he gave a so-called confession. But if as horrendous as his confession was, because like I said, they had like the photographs lined out in front of them, so you got these photographs of these boys, and it's showing, it's like gruesome photographs and stuff, and they're just having him make up stuff about it. And, you know, so his confessions are, you know, a normal person never thinks that they would falsely confess to something they didn't do. So when you hear Jesse's voice on these confessions, you know, saying all these horrible things, you know, it's not difficult to believe, you know, for anybody that hears it. So it's overwhelming to a jury, you know, who hears that. But if you look at the facts and look at the facts of the case and everything like that, you could totally tell that he's just making it all up and none of it matches the facts. But most people, and especially the jury, they didn't do that. They're just like, oh, he admitted to it, then he did it, you know.
So what was he convicted of ultimately?
one first-degree murder and 2 second-degree murder charges. And he was given life for the first degree and two 20-year sentences for the 2 second-degree murders.
And so how did your trial feel for you? Like, how did you feel being a kid, you know, sitting in a courtroom knowing that people were examining your life?
It was real scary because, I remember when I was arrested, right, the police were talking to me. They're like, hey, where were you? And so I was like, okay, I remember where I was. You know, I started telling them where I was at, what I was doing. And they would just stop me. Like, no, you're lying. We know you're lying because your friend has told us otherwise. And I'm like, who is this friend? What are you talking about? Whoever this is. And they wouldn't tell me it was Jesse. You know, they were trying to get me to guess a name. They're like, oh, you know who it was. You tell us, you know, who you think it was. And if I'd have guessed Barry Scheck, you know, they'd have went and arrested him. They were just fishing for more names. But I'm like, whoever this person is not my friend. They're a liar. You know, that's what I'm thinking in my mind. Whoever it says is lied. But then I started thinking, well, maybe the police are just lying to me and nobody said these things. You know, I didn't know. The only thing I knew was where I was at and that I didn't do the crime. And so that's the only thing I could tell them. I didn't play any guessing games with them because that's what they tried to make me do, is start guessing things, you know. And then what they would do, whatever I guessed, they would reverse it and say that's what I said as a matter of fact, right? And so that's what they ended up doing to Damien, you know. And like when they questioned him out in front of my house, you know, they just made him start guessing things where they would like, you know, don't you think it's possible? What makes you think it wouldn't be possible? You know, and then he's like, I don't know. This is possible, I guess, you know. And so I refused to do that with them, you know. And so, but I remember them taking my fingerprints and then taking my handprints, my footprints, my blood, my saliva, my hair, all these different things. And I thought, okay, these things right here are going to prove I'm innocent. They don't want to believe me for whatever reason, you know, and that's okay. They'll get past that once they do the science, you know. So I'm in jail for like several months, and then they come and take all this evidence from me again because it turned out they didn't have a warrant for it the night of my arrest. And, you know, as an innocent person, I'm like, you know, it doesn't matter. I don't care about a warrant. You know, I just want to prove my innocence. I'm like, you could have my hair, my blood, my saliva. You can take my handprints, footprints. You can take that from me every single day if it helps you prove who did this crime and prove that I'm innocent, you know. And so that's what I pinned all my hopes on, not all the prejudicial, satanic mumbo jumbo that had nothing to do with the crime, you know. And so when the trial starts, I'm waiting for them to start talking about evidence and stuff like that. But instead, it's just all prejudicial, circumstantial stuff. And I remember Bourdier, my attorney's like, all right, Paul Ford, he was like, all right, I want you to look at these jurors, these possible jurors, and tell me what type of feeling you get from them, you know, and stuff. And I'm like, I can't see that far. I can't see the jurors because, you know, I can't see maybe half a foot in front of my face before things just get really blurry, you know, and all I can just do is make out shapes. And he's like, oh, you know, well, when we win the case and I get you home, I'm going to take you and buy you a pair of glasses myself, you know. And I was able to make it in class because in class they seat you alphabetically, and since my last name was Baldwin, I'd sit up close to the board, you know, and in front of the class, and the teachers write big enough on the chalkboard where I can, you know, kind of make out what it was, you know, especially when they're explaining things. But in the courtroom, you're far away from the prosecutor, you're far away from the judge, you're far away from the jury box, you're far away from the people, you know, spectating, you know, the trial. You're far away from the witness stand. So I couldn't see anything, and I'm hard of hearing as well. And so I couldn't hear a lot of it going on, you know. And I just remember what one of the things I did hear was a judge saying, no matter what you see, no matter what you hear, do not show any emotion. Don't let there be any emotional outburst, right? Or you're going to go back to the jail and you're not going to be able to witness your trial. And, you know, and even though I couldn't hardly hear or see anything, I tried to, you know, maintain the zen-like, you know, pose, you know, to not let anything, you know, rattle me, to just be, you know, good, you know, to do what he told me to do. And the newspapers and stuff, like, made a big deal of that even, you know, and it didn't matter what emotion I showed or what I did. The newspapers at the time were going to turn it into something negative. I remember in the county jail, you know, they didn't have barbers come see you or whatever, but Miss Curden, the lady who ran the county jail, cut my hair with a straight razor, you know, and it was really weird, but no one cut Damien's hair. So he gets to court and his hair is grown out long, and his attorney, Scott Davidson and Val Price, asked the judge, like, Your Honor, can we get our client's hair cut, you know, before this trial starts? And Burnett's like, I'm not going to have a barber come here. If you want to do it, you can do it. You know, telling his attorney that. And so Val Price cut Damien's hair right there in the courtroom, right before court started. And Damien's like, I want to see what it looks like, see how you ruined my hair. And, you know, and so they get like the little mirror that the bailiff uses to look up under the seats and stuff like that, or up under cars. So they hand that mirror to Damien, right, to look at his hair, and he's sitting there, you know, combing it, and he was like, I guess it'll do, you know. And somebody took a photo of him combing his hair, and they wrote a big article about him not really taking the trial seriously, you know, he's taking the time to comb his hair and stuff like that. So it didn't matter what he did, what he was doing. I remember at one point, like, his mom and his sister and stuff like that were telling him, like, when we were coming in and out of courts, because people were, like, so horrible and mean. They would just cuss us out, tell us we're going to burn in hell, we deserve to fry, and, like, all these horrible things as we're coming in and out of the courtroom and stuff like that. But Damien's mom were, like, telling him, don't worry, Damien, the truth will set you free, we're on your side and stuff. And so they blew a kiss at him, and he blew a kiss back, right? But then somebody from the media took a photo of him doing that and then wrote a newspaper article saying Damien blows kisses at the victim's family and stuff like that. So they just took something innocent, totally innocent, and would just twist it and make it to something totally negative. And that's the only story that the people in the jury pool were receiving. It's this totally sensationalized stuff.
Yeah, how was your attorney?
I remember my attorney, you know, at the time I thought, you know, he was a great attorney. You know, of course, I didn't really have no experience except for the guy I had when I was 11, Mr. Montgomery, who told me not to worry about anything. But yeah, but then next thing you know, in the courtroom, he's sitting there saying 2 years in reform school would do him some good. I'm like, what? You know, so this attorney, Paul Ford, wasn't like that. He was actually fighting for us and stuff like that. But he never called me as a witness. He never called my great-granduncle as a witness. He never called any of the people I'd seen as a witness or had seen me. He never called any of my witnesses.
Did you want to testify?
Oh, yes, I did. You know, I was like, hey, I will get up there. It doesn't matter. You know, I will tell everybody where I was at, what I was doing, and all that stuff, you know. But he never called me, you know, and I remember after the trial, he was like, you know, we'll get it on appeal. You won't be in prison for more than a year. You know, I'll get you out, you know. And I remember he told me, like, at the beginning of the trial, he's like, he goes, what do you think about my hair? Because his hair had started getting long and he could put it in ponytail. He said, I'm going to keep growing it until you go home, Jason. I was like, I remember thinking, you know, that was pretty cool, you know, but at the same time, I was just a kid and didn't know anything about the legal process, didn't know anything about the law or anything like that. And so to me, he was on my side, you know. I remember in the county jail, like, I was starving to death in there. I was always hungry. Like, right before I got locked up, I remember I weighed myself over at my uncle's house on his scale, and I was 112 pounds. And I remember on my 16th birthday, right, standing up almost face to face with my mom. She was just a little bit taller than me. I was like, oh, I'm almost as tall as you now, Mom, you know? And so when I get to prison and have my first visit that's not behind the glass and got to hug my mom and stuff, I was like a foot taller than her. So I went through my whole growth stage while I was in the jail. And I remember I was just always hungry. My family couldn't bring me any money, couldn't bring me anything to eat. And the food that the jail served was really good. It was just like the food they served in the school cafeteria, you know, but it just wasn't enough. I'm like, as soon as I get through eating it, I'd still be hungry. Like I want two trays or three, but you only get one, you know? And so I was always hungry. And so when my attorneys would come visit me, we would go to a conference room and they would close the door and it'd just be me and them. And my attorney would like bring a pizza in his briefcase, like a whole pizza and like a couple of Mountain Dews and a couple of candy bars. And so I would just like eat the whole thing, you know, and that's the only time I wouldn't be hungry.
How long did the trial last?
It was 17 days, but it was really longer than that if you count the weekends. So a few weeks.
And how long did the jury deliberate?
I think it was 10 hours.
So ultimately, what were you convicted of?
The only thing that they could find me guilty of or not guilty of was capital murder, which automatically carried life without parole or the death penalty.
Wow. And what about Damien?
The same thing.
Same
thing.
They
found him. Yeah. But they gave him the death penalty and gave me life without. And I think they gave me life without because I was 16. I looked like I was 14. So they had some type of sympathy for me, but they still found me guilty for something I didn't do. And Damien, you know, the prosecution made him out like he was this ringleader and satanic leader and then made a big deal out of his name being Damien and everything. And so they just totally prejudiced the jury against him. And the newspapers at the time would have headlines like the devil on trial and things like that.
Tell me about prison or as a 16-year-old who looked like a 14-year-old.
Well, at first, everybody was trying to kill me, you know, because they had been watching the news. Like it was the most highly publicized trial in Arkansas history. And the worst thing you can go to prison is for is, you know, messing with kids or hurting kids or murdering kids or, you know, raping women and things like that. So the way the state did it, they said that we had sexually assaulted the kids and that we had killed them. And so for a whole year, the prison population and the people who worked at the prison have been hearing this narration. And so they've been telling each other, oh, well, wait till they get here. You know, we're going to do this to them. We're going to do that to them. You know, so it's like they'd held like a year-long pep rally, you know, to get ready. And so when I first got to prison, I ended up going to Barner, which was nicknamed Gladiator School, Little Saigon, and all these other monikers, you know, because it was such a terrible place. It was the worst prison in Arkansas Department of Corrections at the time. And I fought the whole time I was there, you know, first few years. Like, I got my skull shattered. I got my collarbone broke. I had my teeth knocked out. I mean, I've had my teeth since rebuilt, but, like, they just treated me like the worst of the worst, you know, and it was not a good experience. But, you know, at the time I was worried about my mom and my brothers because they're going through something similar, even though they're not locked up, like the community turned against them. Like my mom lost her job. My brother, Matt and Terry, Matthew was 14, Terry was 9. And so they arrested me on my last day of school for the 10th grade. But the school had started up by the time my trial kicked in. And so my little brothers had to go back to school, right? But everybody who didn't live in the trailer park, you know, even though they had showed prejudice towards everybody in the trailer park before, but now they're targeting my brothers specifically because they're my brothers and my brothers would get into fights. And so they'd go to the principal's office and the principal would expel them because they're like, oh, you're that satanic child killer's brother, you know? So there was no peace for them. And so anytime I'd write my mom and stuff like that, write my brothers, I'd tell them, I wouldn't tell them anything about anything bad. You know, it was like, I would just try to put a positive spin on it, tell them what I was doing. I got to go outside and work out in the field and stuff like that, but I wouldn't tell them how brutal it was, that it's really slave labor and that people were beating me up and breaking my bones and stuff, because my family couldn't really come visit me, you know, that often, you know, because they didn't have any money, even though they didn't have to pay rent. You know, you still got to pay for electricity, gas, things like that, which my mom didn't have money for. You know, she barely afford a stamped envelope.
How long were you in prison?
18 years. But as the years went on, you know, I worked hard. I treated everybody I came in contact with dignity and respect. And people finally started, you know, respecting me and started believing in me and stuff, and started to realize that, you know, just, you know, one of the things I hated for them to say a lot of times, you know, people would be like, whether you did it or not, I think you're still a good dude. You know, I'm like, well, I did not do this crime, you know. And so even then, years later, people finally would start believing in me. And it was, you know, I was just lucky that HBO filmed the trial, you know, and they came down and filmed the trial and its completion, because if they had not done that and shown the world that we got railroaded, you know, the state of Arkansas would have executed Damien, and Jesse and I, you know, would still be there, you know, with life and life without.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about your steps leading to your release.
Oh, it was a huge monumental effort. I remember Damien's trial, I mean Jesse's trial attorney, Dan Stidham, after our direct appeals were over with, he was the only attorney that still would do anything for us, right? The other attorneys all moved on to other cases and things like that. But I remember him sending me a pro se, which means on your own, Rule 37. He was like, hey, you know, if you don't file this, you know, within 30 days, you're going to be what's called procedurally barred, and I can't file it for you because I'm not your attorney, and I can't be your attorney because I was Jesse's trial attorney, but I'm the only one who really cares about you guys right now, you know, so do this. Yeah, so here's your Rule 37. He goes, it doesn't have anything you really need, but along with that is a motion to hold the Rule 37 hearing in abeyance. That means put it on pause. So what it did is it allowed us to get motion in there, right, in time, so we wouldn't get procedurally barred, and then put the judge's ruling on pause until we could find attorneys to actually work on the case. So the time wouldn't run out, right? So it was a stroke of genius on his part, and just showed how what of a great person and good person he was. And really, it was so lucky for us, right? Because nobody else did that. And I ran into so many other cases of people where nobody did that for them, and their cases were allowed to be procedurally barred or whatever, and they didn't get any help. So by him doing that, and then Judge Burnett, you know, did not dream that we would end up getting help years later. He never pushed the issue on the motion to, like, have it ruled on or whatever before we got attorneys. He just kind of was like, people will forget about this case and Damien will be executed and Jason and Jesse will be forgotten, you know. But that didn't happen because the trials were recorded, you know, by HBO, even though the documentaries wouldn't come out until a couple of years later in 1996. Well, when they came out,
what's it called?
Paradise Lost. But by the time they came out, the time limit had already run out for Rule 37, you know. So by Dan Stidham filing that, you know, and putting it on pause, that saved our cases. It saved all of our cases. And that was an amazing thing for him to do, you know. And he even filed one on himself as Jesse's attorney, you know, and sent it in, you know, as if Jesse had written it pro se, which is something not many attorneys do, to say, hey, I screwed this case up, you know. But procedurally, it's a step you have to take. If you skip any step in the appeals process, the Supreme Court, State Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, the United States Supreme Court can just not even look at your case. You know, they can deny your case without even looking at it because they will say you have not exhausted all your legal remedies, right? So you have to file a Rule 37. You know, even if you think your attorney did the best job in the world, you have to, because if you skip that step, they will procedurally bar you. And you think that the justice system is about finding the truth, but it's not. At that point, it's all about finality. You know, they want the case to not be re-looked at, to not be re-examined, to not, you know, they don't want that to happen. They want the case to be over with, and that's it. You know, no second guessing it. And that, to me, that's wrong, because all systems, you know, anything that's human made is subject to human error. Even if the police, you know, had 100% pure motives and weren't maliciously trying to prosecute an innocent person, let's just say they just made innocent mistakes, you know, that happens, you know. And so for courts to not give you any way to address that, or to say that they never convict innocent people, is wrong, you know. So, but luckily, Dan filed that for us. And so when the documentaries did come out, our cases were preserved. And so people around the country, around the world, were able to see our trials and recognize that, you know, hey, that something's terrible has happened, you know. And for Joe and Bruce Sanofsky and Joe Berlinger, the documentarians, like after our trials and after they finished, you know, filming and stuff, they couldn't believe that we were convicted, and they made a promise to one another that they would keep working filming on our case until we were released, you know, because they couldn't believe the injustice of it. They had actually did a documentary a year or two before that called My Brother's Keeper on another murder trial in New York about an innocent guy. But at this time, the juries found this guy innocent, you know, and so they were expecting, you know, something similar for us. But, you know, after they figured out we were innocent, they thought we would be found not guilty, you know. So they had no idea it would take almost 2 decades, you know, for us to get released. And so this lady, Kathy Bach in Los Angeles, she worked for an agency that made movie posters for movies, right? And so she got a copy of Paradise Lost before it was released, like to the movies and stuff like, because she has to see it before it goes out in the movies to be able to make the poster, right? So she gets it, you know, just as part of her daily job, you know, of reviewing movies and making cool posters, you know. She's like, oh my God, I can't believe this, you know, as she's watching it. And so she calls all of her best friends, Burke Stalls, Grove Pashley, Lisa Fancher. She's like, you guys have got to watch this, you know, and these are all people that live in Los Angeles, and they couldn't believe it. They're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, and so they wrote to Damien, they wrote to Jesse, they wrote to me, and this is like, it was so amazing a feeling, you know, for someone to get letters from people, you know, who were not my family members, who didn't know me, you know, because, yeah, my mom knows I'm innocent. Yeah, my uncle, my great-granduncle knows I'm innocent. Yeah, my next-door neighbor, you know, believes in me and knows I couldn't do anything like that. But to have someone totally not related to me to say, you know what, I believe you, was an injection of hope, you know. And so they're like, hey, we want to come see you and try to figure out something to do. So they came and visited all three of us, and then they met with Dan Stidham, who had filed the Rule 37s for us, and he told them point blank, he said, listen, if the people in this room right now don't do something for these guys, nobody will. And so at the time, the internet wasn't a big thing, you know. It was, you know, personal computers. People didn't have computers, you know, in their homes and stuff yet. There, you know, people didn't have cell phones and things like that. And so they created a website for us called WN3.org. And in it, they just started, you know, downloading the trial transcripts and anything and everything related to the case. And it actually became like one of the first cases to be crowdsourced by people, because people who've seen the, you know, when the documentaries were released and you know, people can, you know, go to the movie theater and watch them. And then when they got available on HBO, people from all over the country and the world were like, "Oh my God, you know, these kids are innocent. You know, what's being done?" And so then they could log on to the internet and put a search in, and they would be led to WN3.org. And so people, so they started like a fund to raise money to hire us attorneys. And then once we got attorneys, you know, to pay for things like DNA testing and pay for private investigators to, you know, go and talk to witnesses and stuff like that, you know, so it was a, it took years, you know, but it was a big deal. And without any of it, you know, we would still be where we, you know, we would still be in prison. And right now, Arkansas is getting ready to execute 8 people, and I have no doubt they would have put Damien on that list.
So, what were the terms of your release? Like, you made a deal, right? Did I read that right?
It was called an Alford plea when you the it's kind of like a stalemate between the defense and the state, where you are allowed, it's not a guilty plea. You're able to say and maintain that you are in fact innocent, you know, but in the interest, in the best interest of the state, you will accept time served, you know, and go home right now if you don't sue the state for wrongful imprisonment. And honestly, I refused the Alford plea when it was first offered to me. I was like, "No way." You know, we've won an evidentiary hearing. We have a new judge, Judge Lacer, who is, you know, from all intents and purposes, a reasonable judge, not like Judge Burnett, the guy who was on our trial and on our appeals for so many years. That guy is not reasonable, and I believe, you know, just a total crook. And so I had hope, but at the same time, you know, my life was different than Damien's at this point. You know, Damien was sitting in a like a concrete coffin on death row. He had the very real threat, you know, of the state. You know, he had to wake up every morning thinking, you know, today could be my last day. The state could try to kill me today, you know. And he had no programs, nothing, no job, nothing he could do to, like, you know, make his time more bearable. And like, you know, when I first went in and people beat me and broke my bones, shattered my skull, you know, and just called me the most horrible things. But at this point, around the Alford plea, that wasn't happening anymore, you know. Everybody was my friend. You know, the guards respected me and you know, cared for me. You know, they cared about what happened. You know, people would, you know, say, "Hey, you know, I went to a Pearl Jam concert and they said, 'Free to West of Us 3,' you know," and this was a guard telling me that, you know, and they would tell me, "You know, I'm praying for you. You know, my wife is praying for you. My grandmother is praying for you. You know, we're all praying for you, and I hope you get to go home someday," you know, and stuff like that. And so everybody was nice to me and wanted me to go home. You know, everybody that I came into contact with, you know, even the other inmates, I never even locked my locker box in the barracks. Nobody would steal my stuff. Nobody would raise a hand to me. You know, I mean, everybody was nice to me. I worked in the school at this point. I helped people get their GEDs and go home, you know, so my life had meaning. You know, I found meaning in my work because I've always been a helper. I've always, you know, wanted people to succeed. I've always wanted people to have things that they wanted. I've always wanted people, you know, to fulfill their dreams and stuff like that. And so I was able to do that by working in the school and help people, you know. And even though I was still in prison and it was not where I deserved to be, and it was definitely not where I wanted to be, I had a life that I'd built, you know, over the years. So it really wasn't hard for me to, you know, want to keep fighting, even if it would have taken another 18 years, you know. But I could not make that decision for Damien. I could not make that decision for Jesse, you know. Their experiences were different than mine. You know, Jesse was developmentally challenged, so he had not been able to, you know, even though he had to work as a slave as well, you know, he had, you know, just mental issues and, you know, and emotional issues, and his dad Jesse's dad came and visited him every week, right? Jesse's dad is like a saint. He never missed a visit, you know, until that last year we were there, he got dementia and his health did a 180 and he wasn't able to come see Jesse anymore. And I know Jesse was thinking, I might never see my dad again, you know? I remember the night we got arrested. Damien's mom was younger then than I am now. Like, I remember she rented a VCR and a TV and stuff and all these movies. And her and Damien's dad, Joe, were going to this new casinos that were opening up in Mississippi, right? They're supposed to be the new Las Vegas, right? So they were young and vibrant and full of life. But after 18 years of us being in prison and her suffering grief and heartache from all that, she's no longer that young, vibrant person. She's now in a wheelchair taking oxygen, you know? And so people's lives, you know, were ruined. And my own mother, you know, grief has just taken a toll, you know, on her and my brothers, you know, their lives were totally derailed and destroyed because of this. And so I couldn't make that decision for myself. You know, I had to think of all of these people who cared for us, who wished and prayed for us on every day and who carried all this huge burden of grief. You know, I had to think of Damien being on death row and while I was in there, I always had this nightmare, you know, that they actually executed Damien. And honestly, I wouldn't be able to live with myself knowing I was given the choice to save his life, no matter how crappy of a choice it was. And I didn't take it and they ended up killing him. That I don't even like to think about that, you know. And so I had to take the deal, you know. It's shame on the state for forcing innocent people into doing that, you know, to threaten, you know, an innocent person with murder, you know, if you don't take a deal to save them what, you know, what the prosecutor Scott Ellington said was $60 million. You know, that's the only thing they were concerned about, that and to continue the fallacy that Arkansas doesn't convict innocent people, that their system is perfect, you know, but no system is perfect. But the courts and the people who write the laws know it's not perfect. So they write laws in there to where you can have appeals and things like that to correct an injustice. Like in 2001, Act 1780 was passed in Arkansas, which is the actual innocence statute. And in it, you know, they say the purpose of the judicial system is to exonerate the innocent and punish the guilty. And they recognize, you know, that it is possible for an innocent person, you know, through circumstance or whatever, to be found guilty. You know, it happens, but there are rules in place to correct those mistakes. But you have people, right, that are in the positions as the gatekeepers, you know, to enforce these rules. You have them saying, no, we don't make mistakes, and we're not going to use these laws that we have to free the innocent. And so that's a problem, you know, that's a huge problem. And Arkansas to this day are still saying they don't convict innocent people. And there's, I know for a fact, there are other innocent people in there right now. And, you know, it just makes it that much more difficult for them to get justice. I've gotten to be pretty close and good friends with Pam Hicks, one of the boys' mothers who were murdered, little Stevie's mom, you know, and I've been able to see her a couple of times since I've been free. And when I look in her eyes, I see the same grief that I've seen in my own mom's eyes when she lost me, you know. And to tell her that her son doesn't matter, that $60 million is more important than to try to actually find who committed this crime, is not just. It's not right, you know. That is not what the purpose of the judicial system is, you know. That money should not even be a factor to them. You know, they should not care about that. They should say, we're going to overturn this case and pursue whoever did this crime, no matter how long it takes, you know, no matter how many resources we have to spend, because that is our purpose. But they didn't do that, you know. And so it's been very hard for her. And she doesn't get any support, you know, from the state or anything like that. They don't help her.
Do you remember the day you went home?
Oh yeah, it was August 19th of 2011. My poly tattooed that on her wrist with a little tree, and every year on that date she adds a new leaf. But
That's
yeah,
awesome.
yeah, it is awesome. I met some amazing people, but yeah.
What was it like to be free after, you went away as a child and came back as a man? How was that?
You know, like I said, I had jobs in prison, and I came into contact with people who were free every day. All my supervisors, you know, wore real clothes instead of like prison guard uniforms, you know. And so I communicated with people who were free. I talked to people on the telephone who were free. I watched television and listened to the radio of people who were free, you know. And so I wasn't locked in a cell. I lived in an open barracks, so where I had to interact with other people, you know, socially. And so it really wasn't that difficult for me to reacclimate to society. I had access to computers while I was inside. I taught myself, you know, how to use a computer, and I had people that helped me learn how to use a computer and stuff. I learned office skills and stuff like that. I got my GED, I got college education and stuff. I read tons and tons and tons of books, like part of the organization that WM3 org, who helped us, you know, get free and everything, also had like a book wish list. So if I wanted a book, I could send for it, you know. So you read about other people's experiences, and you know, most of those books are written by people who are free. And so it wasn't that difficult. I will say that it was awesome being free because, you know, I
Right.
mean, there's nothing that compares to freedom, you know. You definitely don't want to lose your freedom. I had to learn to drive when I got out. I had this really amazing guy who used to work Amazon, David Robinson, taught me how to drive, and his method was totally hands off. He would just like come pick me up in his Honda Accord. He'd throw me the keys, and he'd just be like, "Do whatever you want." And he would just sit in the passenger
Oh,
seat,
wow.
you know, texting on his phone or whatever. But as I got accustomed to driving, you know, he would be like, "All right, in about 3 or 4 blocks, make a right-hand turn somewhere," you know, but he would give me enough time to walk, you know, get in the correct lane or whatever, you know, and stuff like that to make a right-hand turn. You know, and we did this like, you know, for a few hours every week. He would come and for a driving test, you know. And then one day he was like, "All right, see that parking lot up there, pulling in it, and then put the car in reverse and just drive in reverse." So I would drive in reverse for like 30 minutes, nothing but reverse, just going around in this parking lot until I got totally accustomed to it. But he never once raised his voice at me or yelled at me or anything like that. And it was just totally laid back, like, "Here in a few blocks, make a left-hand turn," you know. And so by doing that, you know, driving with him and then downloading the driver's manual and studying that, I was able to pass my driver's exam the first time, you know. And
Good for you.
yeah, and that's awesome to be able to drive. You know, I got a bike, you know, and I can just go, you know, drive to biking trails and go, you know, bike and see nature and the country and stuff. Went to concerts and stuff. Like, people have just been so incredibly nice and to me since I've been free, you know, like rock stars. Like, when I first got out, I lived with Eddie Vedder at his house in Seattle. Like, lived with him and his family and got to know his family really well, and they just like welcomed me in. I like ate dinner and breakfast with them and all this stuff, you know, and they helped me get a job, you know, and then helped me get my first apartment, helped me go to school and get my education, you know. They put Pearl Jam has this organization called Vitalogy, and it's where they do all their philanthropic work, you know, for causes and stuff the band members and stuff believe in. So they put together like a scholarship fund for me to go to school. I mean, because of the documentaries and people became aware of the case, you know, me, Damian, Jesse got so much support that most innocent people don't get, you know. And so like Lars Ulrich and Metallica, when they did like their 30th year anniversary at the Fillmore, they like invited me and Holly to go, you know. So like, when I was, I remember being inside, I'm like, man, Metallica's going to retire before I ever get out. And I'll never see them live in concert. You know, that used to be one of my little fears, you know, while I was in there, like, man, I'm not going to be able to get out in time to go see Metallica play, you know, but I got to see them, and they're on tour now. And, the weirdest thing is Lars is, I got his number, he's got mine. And he's like, hey, we're gonna be in Texas and got a few shows. You wanna come? I'm like, yeah, thank you. Acclimation is different for me.
I've been reading up on you, and it seems like you have turned your tragedy into hope for some other people. So I was hoping you could tell me about that, about Proclaim Justice.
Exactly. Me and my good friend John Harden started Proclaim Justice. This guy, John Harden, he worked in another organization called Arkansas Take Action while I was still in prison, and they built this organization. It was him, my wife Holly, Damien's wife Lori, and some other people from Arkansas, because when the documentaries came out, the media in Arkansas were like, oh, don't listen to the people in Hollywood. Don't listen to the people in New York. They don't know what's going on in Arkansas. You know, don't listen to them. We got the right people. Believe us. You know, so that was the Arkansas's police's stance, you know, and the detectives and all that. That's what they were telling the media. Well, John and everybody from Arkansas were like, no, we think you guys got the wrong people. So we're going to start an organization here in Arkansas called Arkansas Take Action to get these boys home, you know, and to educate the people of Arkansas, you know, how screwed up this case is. And so when Damien and Jesse and I were finally freed, John, he was like, I still want to help innocent people, you know, I still want to help, you know, guys are innocent. And he got to be friends with John McCleskey, who started the very first innocent organization called Centurion Ministries. And John told this John, you know, every state can have three or four innocence organizations, and still they would not be able to help everybody that needs help. And so John was talking to me one day after I got out, and he's like, man, I really want to help other people. And I said, you know, when I left that place, I promised those guys in there I would not forget them. And so we're like, well, let's start an organization together. And so for several years, while I was in Seattle and he was down here in Austin, he was like working his butt off to get all the paperwork and licensing and insurance and all the stuff that it takes, you know, to get a nonprofit organization started, you know, insurance, I mean, everything. He worked for several years. And so when he finally got everything put together and got an office and everything, he FaceTimed me up in Seattle. He goes, look, here's your desk. Here's your office. You need to move down here and let's do some good in the world. And I said, let's do it. And Holly quit her job in Seattle, and we drove the 5 days from Seattle down California, across Texas to here. And of course, along the way, we stopped in San Francisco and stayed with some of the attorneys, stayed overnight and had dinner with some of the attorneys that worked on the case. We stopped in LA, which at the time it just fortuitously was Burke Saul's, one of his birthdays. I won't say the number. It just happened to be his birthday. So all the people who worked on WM3.org were there and stuff. So we celebrated with those guys his birthday, and then come through and stopped in El Paso, and this other guy, John Mimbela, who is this, he owns a construction company down there, and he's been working on this guy's case, Daniel Villegas, in El Paso, another innocence guy, for years and years. And so he jumped aboard with us with Proclaim Justice. He's like, hey, I want to help other people too, you know, I can't not help people, you know. And so we had, Holly and I had dinner with him and stuff, and so we drove out here, and here we are in Austin, Texas. I just got my Texas license plate on my Jeep and on Holly's car today. Next thing I got to do is get my Texas driver's license. We stayed with John for several weeks, him and his wife and his kid for several weeks while we looked for an apartment and stuff and everything. And I mean, we've got several cases already we're working on and looking at.
Yeah, what kind of services do you provide? What do you do there?
We're predominantly a investigative service. We have three private investigators who work for us. John is also a private investigator, and so it's strictly investigative. We look at cases, and they don't have to have DNA. Most of the innocence organizations focus primarily on DNA cases, but those are just the tip of the iceberg of innocence cases. So we look, you know, we get letters and stuff in from people, and we look at their, you know, credentials, look at their transcripts and everything, and just reinvestigate a case from the ground up. We have a couple of attorneys who I think are will work for us at cost. We're just getting started. We're getting our feet up under us, and we're trying to help some innocent people, you know, get free.
What advice would you give to someone who finds themselves being wrongly accused or wrongly convicted of a crime?
Do not talk to the police, because they are not after the truth. You think they are. You think they just want to solve the crime, but that's not it. They just want someone to go down. You think that if you tell them where you're at, what you were doing, that they're going to accept that and you know, work to help you prove that, but that's not the case. They just are trying to convict you for whatever reason. Maybe they're just, I don't know, hardened by working with crime and stuff every day. Maybe they can't see innocence anymore because they've become so dejected and demoralized by, you know, their job or whatever. Or maybe they're just corrupt and don't care that they're innocent, that they're convicting innocent people. They might have the frame of mind that, you know, you're guilty of something, and it doesn't matter if you're guilty of what they're trying to convict you of. You know what? It doesn't matter to them, you know. So when they say what you, when they tell you that what you say can and will be used against you, that is not a, that's they're threatening you, really. Yeah, that's a threat, and they will hold that. So don't say anything to them. To say, I need an attorney, and I need to speak to an attorney, because that's the only person that's going to help you. I was going to say, with phones and stuff like that today, like iPhones and stuff like that, where you can record your whereabouts and stuff, try, if you're an innocent person out there, before you ever even get arrested for something, try to keep some type of record of where you're at and where you're going and what you're doing. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, and that sounds like maybe too much to do, but if you create a record anytime you leave your house or come back to your house or go to work or stuff like that, even if it's just a text message to your significant other or to your mother, to your father, to your brother, sister, or to somebody, that record will help you in case you are falsely accused. And this goes for not just people who've never come in contact with the system. This goes for people who've gotten out of prison, who are innocent, and even people who are just on regular parole for something they did do, you know, who have a record now and who have a strike against them. Protect yourself, you know, because you can be telling the truth of where you are at, and the police are going to say you're lying. Your parents, your friends, everybody who you know, and who would testify about where you were at a given time, the police and prosecution will just say, oh, they're lying because they're your friends and family. And then, you know, for the people who don't know you, who just saw you, the police will intimidate them so much to where they won't even stand up for you, you know? So you've got to protect yourself. That's the type of world we're living in, and it's scary. But with phones, there's an easy way to, you know, to verify your whereabouts, to where if they do that, you can just say, oh, no, I got proof. You don't have to believe me. Trust Apple or whoever, you know, Droid or whatever it is, you know.
So this is my last question. And I get this question a lot from the people who listen to my show. What can the average person like me or my listeners who haven't experienced this do to help people who have been wrongly convicted?
Anytime that there is legislation and bills and stuff like that put forth in, like, in Texas right now, and put forth in front of the Senate, is House Bill or Senate Bill 34, and it's about, they're addressing what they call jailhouse snitches, which are people who lie on innocent people and cut deals wrongful eyewitness legislation where, you know, you might have a witness to a crime, right? And the police lines out a lineup of photographs and the witness is looking at it and they're not really sure because, you know what, they're not seeing the person they think they saw, but the police says, oh, pick one, or they point to one and like, no, pick this one right here. And that has been a leading cause in wrongful conviction too. You know, so anytime there's a bill or something like that to help innocent people, support it. Don't support the candidate or the bills that are supposed to be tough on crime, because there's no such thing as tough on crime. You're only being tough on people, and we're people. And so you're being tough on yourself, you know, and on other people that you should care about. So support in those ways, innocence organizations and stuff like that, like like us right here, Proclaim Justice. We have a website and everything. So if you want to donate some money or some time, we could definitely use that. And I know all the other organizations could use it.
What's your website address?
Proclaimjustice.org.
And I'll add that in my show notes too, so that way people can just click on it. It'll be like a link to it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and really just question the things that the police say and don't take what they say at face value, you know, because they get it wrong. And as there's been countless cases proven, like there's this detective in Chicago that just sent so many in, like, I think there's like 45 people he sent to prison for crimes they didn't do. And like, he just, like, it wasn't an accident or a mistake for him. He just like intentionally sent innocent people to prison and just totally rigged things against them, and made witnesses lie on other people and stuff like that. So there are people who abuse the system, you know, and like, there's a case in Texas, Michael Morton. This guy spent 24 years in prison for murdering his wife, and he didn't murder his wife, you know, and the prosecution had evidence, had a bandana with DNA evidence on it that proved Michael was innocent and proved who the actual killer was. But because it didn't prove Michael did it, he hid that and wouldn't let the defense know about it and told, you know, everybody, oh, that Michael did the crime, you know, and all the evidence points to it. But years later, it was found out, you know, that there was a serial rapist and murderer going around killing women and killed Michael's wife and afterwards went and killed several other women. So if the prosecutor was doing his job, you know, and turned over that evidence, they could have stopped the murder of several other women, you know. And so, and also, we need to make it easier for prosecuting attorneys to, you know, put on the brakes for a prosecution if in their investigation they've come across evidence of innocence. They need to be able to stop and say, you know what, we're going down the wrong road with this case. Let's let this person go or whatever and turn them free and follow the evidence where it leads instead of ignoring the evidence, hiding the evidence, and continuing with a prosecution because they become invested in it or whatever.
Until next time, I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. A special thanks to our sponsors, Hunt a Killer and Pro Flowers, for sponsoring today's episode. Remember, if you can't financially support our sponsors, you can still help by giving them a shout out on social media. And by can, I mean please, please, please do it so they know that you appreciate their support for our show. Visit our website, www.actualinpod.com, for more information about the show. The Actual Innocence Podcast is produced and hosted by me and my amazing volunteers. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks for listening.